All over the news these days, there's a war between the modern nation of Israel and the country of Iran. Iran has been historically known as Persia. The history of the biblical book of Esther goes back some 2,500 years and gives us some insight into the relationship between the tribe of Judah and the nation of Persia. Well, in particular, we're going to take a look at the life of Mordecai living in Persia. In fact, you might use that as a title of today's message, Mordecai Living in Persia. I was a college student driving in my car on a way to the an annual holiday church service on that day that the Bible refers to as the Day of Atonement. We can read about the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 23 and a number of other places in the Bible. In Israel, the Jews call, in the Hebrew language, call that day the day Yom Kippur. The day of Yom Kippur, or Day of Atonement, is a fast day. A fast day is a 24-hour period in which people abstain from food or water from sunset of one day until sunset of the next day. And everybody who keeps this biblical annual holiday is going to be hungry or thirsty on that day. Well, I was driving along the highway on my way to my very first attendance on a Day of Atonement. It was 1973. And there was a news flash on the radio. A war had broken out in the Middle East. The country of Israel was attacked by several of his Arab neighbors, led by Egypt and Syria. The Arab attackers chose the day of Yom Kippur because they knew that the Israeli Jews would be fasting and doing without water or food for a day. Therefore, the Israeli army would be physically and mentally weakened in its ability to defend itself. Egypt had prepositioned 100,000 troops ready to cross the Suez Canal and march into the Sinai Peninsula. However, the Israelis put up a vigorous defense to the Egyptian invasion. Many thousands of people died and their much military equipment was destroyed. At the same time that the Egyptians attacked Israel from the south, the Syrians attacked Israel from the north. And the Yom Kippur war lasted officially from October 2nd until October 25th, but the fighting didn't really stop, the heavy fighting, until October 28th of 1973, but there was continued sporadic fighting until January 18th of 1974. Now, my brother was a college student at that time. He was working on an archaeological project in Israel during that previous summer of 1973. He had then left Israel to go back to college in Pasadena less than 2 months before the Yom Kippur War had started. At that time, OPEC was in the news, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. It was led by Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia and OPEC declared an oil embargo against the United States for supporting Israel in the Yom Kippur War. Gasoline prices increased in the USA. Gasoline rationing was imposed by then-President Nixon. And if your car license plate had ended in an even number, you could put gas in your car on an even-numbered day. If your license plate ended in an odd number, you could put gas in your car on an odd-numbered day. Now, I know it's going to sound weird, but on the before the war in 1973, I purchased gas for 22 point something per gallon. Everything wasn't 0.9. It might be 22.1, 22.3, because a tenth of a cent meant a lot more then than it does now. But the price of gas rose sharply when the war broke out, and by mid-1979, it was hard to find gas for under $1 a gallon. The nation of Israel in 1973 in that war fought diligently, and this Arab-Israeli war called Yom Kippur ended with the survival of the nation of Israel. But the Yom Kippur War of 1973 was not the first modern war fought by Israel for its survival. In 1948, following World War II, the United Nations formed the new nation of Israel as a homeland for the Jews. Eventually, we're going to get to the book of Esther, so you can page there anytime you're ready. In 1948, a war broke out immediately as Arabs around Israel attempted to exterminate this new modern country of Israel. Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon joined forces to wipe out the new Jewish nation. Israel calls this the War of Independence. And somehow, despite all the opposition, Israel survived. In 1967, I was a high school student. Israel was again attacked by its neighbors, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, in another attempt to wipe Israel off the map. The war was from June 5th to June 10th. It's now referred to as the Six-Day War. The Jewish nation of Israel once again survived. Well, today, we're all well aware of the conflict between the modern country of Israel and the modern country of Iran. But prior to 1935, the country of Iran was known as Persia. Well, we read about Persia in the Bible, and we can read throughout the Bible about Persian kings named Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes. We also read about the capture of the nation of Judah by the Babylonians. They were defeated, and the people were hauled away. In fact, there were several waves of the removal of Jews and transported off to Babylon because the nation of Judah was conquered by the Babylonian Empire. But in 539 BC, the Babylonian Empire was in turn conquered by the Persian Empire. And it was about 50 years later, in 486 BC, a new Persian king arose. King Ahasuerus came to power. And at that time, many Jews were still living then under Persian rule, far from home. The tribe of Judah included the tribe of Benjamin. The two tribes had merged. Back in the land of Israel, it was known, when they were there, it was known as the Southern Kingdom. After the days of Solomon, the kingdom is divided, the 12 tribes of Israel, 10 in the north, 2 in the south. And if we read in 1 Kings 11:35, the northern kingdom was conquered and carried away by the Assyrians, never to return home. They became known as the 10 lost tribes. It was over 100 years later, the southern kingdom of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin were conquered and then removed by the Babylonians. I will note that at that time, Islam was not a religion of Persia. Islam was not even founded for over 1,000 years later, in the 600s AD. The Jews, including the tribe of Benjamin, were living far from home then under the Persian control in 500 and something BC. When we start reading the book of Esther, we read about the Persian king Ahasuerus. Now, Persia was a huge empire. It stretched from India to Egypt. And if you're looking at a world map, you can't walk across it in one day. It's bigger than Texas. Okay, it is a very huge area of the known world that was conquered by Persia. In chapter 1 of the book of Esther, the queen Vashti, the king's queen, was deposed for refusing to obey the king. In chapter 2 of the book of Esther, the king was advised and then followed up with the advice to set up a search for the most beautiful unmarried woman in the land to bring up a new queen, and a young Hebrew gal named Hadassah, her Persian name was Esther, was one of the many young ladies that was selected to be considered a future queen of the Persian Empire, and thereby possibly the new wife of King Ahasuerus. But the parents of Hadassah, also called Esther, had died when she was young. Esther was raised by her cousin Mordecai. Obviously, there was some age difference between Mordecai and his young cousin Esther. Now, my wife and I have a grandson who's 26 years old. And we also have a granddaughter who's 10 months old. They're about 26 years apart. So we can see how cousins, first cousins, can have an age gap. In this case, their mothers were 17 years apart. So the eldest of one and the youngest of another presented that 26-year age gap. Esther and the other young ladies being considered in preparation for the selection process to see who would become the new queen, they were isolated. But Esther was given 7 personal servants to see her to her every need. And her cousin Mordecai, who was the parent who raised her, instructed Esther not to mention her ethnic background as a Hebrew or as a Jew. And as we read the book of Esther, we realize that Mordecai had a great working relationship with his adoptive daughter Esther. And it appears that there's a great deal of respect and honor between the two. If we look in Esther chapter 2 and verse 20, and this is when Esther, Mordecai said, don't mention who you are, your background. And so Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him. And that was her custom. Her pattern is that they had that close relationship, and her cousin was indeed her foster father. In the book of Esther, chapter 2, in verses 19 and 21, we read that this Mordecai, Esther's older cousin, had some kind of responsible job in the palace of the Persian king. Mordecai was, as it says, sitting in the gate in both verses, which is a way of saying he was a responsible decision maker of some kind. If we take a look at the Beyond Today Bible commentary, that Mordecai... it says, Mordecai remains constantly concerned over Esther's welfare. She continues to follow her instructions. And then they theorize she may have given him an official position. In other words, through her influence to be a decision maker. The expositor's notes in this commentary on verses 19 and 20, Mordecai's position at the gate was not that of an idler. In other words, just somebody begging at the gate or at an entrance somewhere, like we see on a street corner. But the position at the gate, the men were represented a kind of duty or official position. He may have been appointed to his position or influenced by Esther to have easier access in the palace to the royal quarters. Men who sat in the gate were frequently elders, leading, respected citizens who settled disputes who were brought before them. We have some verses in the Bible, and I won't go over them all, there are many, that give a sense of what the scripture means when it speaks of sitting in the gate. Well, what happens in the gate? An examination of the verses, nowhere do we say that a Christian shouldn't sit in the gate, because decisions or judgments had to be made. And if we read, and just skipping through some of these, in the book of Ruth, Boaz went up to the gate and sat there, and behold, a close relative of whom Boaz had spoken of. And Boaz said, come aside, friend, sit down here. And so he came aside, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city and sit down and sat down. In other words, it was a place where Boaz was bargaining for the marriage of Ruth. So the gate was a place where decisions were made. There were people who could witness those decisions. In Ruth 4, verses 9 through 11, when Boaz said, you're the witnesses this day that I have purchased all that was Elimelech's and his offspring from the hand of Naomi. And that included the right to marry Ruth, the widow of Mahlon. And so there were witnesses that had gone through, but this was done in a public place at what they call in the gate. When Absalom, the son of King David, was trying to overthrow the throne of King David in 2 Samuel 1, or except in Samuel 15, Absalom, it says in verse 2, would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. Whoever one came, had a lawsuit, came to the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him and say, what city are you from? And they would say, your servant is from thus and such of a tribe of Israel. And so Absalom then would assume the position of making a decision before they even got to the king. It was the king's son, so it must be official, right? And so he won the hearts of the people in making those, in making decisions. In the book of Job, chapter 29 and verse 7, it says, when I went out to the gate by the city, I took my seat in the open square. Apparently Job was sitting as a judge or a decision maker in the city in the open square. Proverbs 22, verse 22, We are advised, do not rob the poor because he's poor, nor oppress the afflicted at the gate. People came for relief, for a decision at the gate where governmental decisions were made. You don't oppress those people who are coming for relief. In Lamentations chapter 5 and verse 14, it's a rather striking thought. Of course, there's a lot of grief. That's why they call it the Book of Lamentations here. In chapter 5 and verse 14, the elders have ceased gathering at the gate, and the young men from their music. In other words, all of a sudden, things that were happening stopped. Okay, it was a tragic time in history. In 2 Samuel 19:8, the king arose and sat in the gate. And they told all the people, saying, there's the king sitting in the gate. And all the people came before the king, for every one of Israel had fled to his tent. In other words, he was saying, it's time to get back to business and get back to the decision making. And so the whole idea is that you go to the gate for the decisions to establish justice. In Amos 5:15, we read, hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gate. So while Mordecai was sitting at the gate of King Ahasuerus, Mordecai discovered while he was there that there was a plot to kill the king. And Mordecai then reported this plot to the king. The conspirators were caught, they were hanged, and an official record was made revealing the plot to kill King Ahasuerus. That's pretty significant. And then we go to chapter 3 in the book of Esther. You can tell I'm moving rather fast through the book of Esther. The king appointed a man named Haman to become a chief administrator of the Persian Empire. Now, if you can imagine, this had to be a huge job for an empire that stretches from India to Egypt, a hugely responsible job. And can you imagine what an ego bender it is, a head exploder, for somebody who was given the job to be an administrator under the king, the emperor of such a big area. And we're in chapter 3, and of course, he would want honor and homage paid to him, because after all, he was like the under king. Kind of reminds me of when I worked in Los Angeles many years ago for the Chinese, a Chinese-owned company, and there was parking spot number 1, parking spot number 2, parking spot number 3, and parking spot number 4. Parking spot number 1 went to the guy that was there first, the national sales manager, and that was hard to get into, to get around the gate and then get in, but that was number 1. Parking spot number 2 was the president of the company. That was easy to get in. Parking spot number 3 was the general manager. And then parking spot number 4 was whoever got there next, which was always me, meaning I always took spot number 4. Even I was there first, spot number 4. Remarkable thing happened when you park in spot number 4. Everybody started bowing. Everybody started saying, good morning, Mr. Martins. Remarkable. And then, when the national sales manager left after 1 month, I inherited his job. Now I'm parking in spot number 1. Whoa, you should see all the people that were willing to pay homage. I'm going, what's going on? And I found out it was cultural. They were all, and I'm thinking, it's just a parking space. No, for them, it was an important position to be in. I'm thinking, I'm just coming here to go to work. But they saw this much more than that. So I can see just this public position for Haman. He expected everybody to basically honor him. But in chapter 3 at verse 2 in Esther, Mordecai would not bow or pay homage to Haman. And this lack of public respect displeased Haman. And so he tried to find a way to kill Mordecai. But this was obviously going to be hard to do. Can't make it too obvious. And then Haman discovered that Mordecai was a Jew. He was a Hebrew. And Haman figured if he couldn't find a way to kill Mordecai directly, he could get rid of Mordecai by trying to kill all the Hebrews, all the Jews. And this, we read in the verse before where King Ahasuerus promoted Haman and set him above all the other administrators or princes around him. And so all those other people around the king and Haman paid homage and they bowed to Haman. Mordecai wasn't doing that. He wasn't bowing. So aren't we just supposed to bow and pay homage to people who are in authority? Clearly, Mordecai didn't do that. If we read the Beyond Today Bible commentary, many see an Agagite as meaning a descendant of King Agag of the Amalekites in the days of Saul. And we can look back on 1 Samuel 15. Josephus refers to Haman as being by birth an Amalekite. It's in Josephus's book, Antiquities of the Jews. And Jewish tradition agrees. So an Amalekite, a branch of the Edomites, were ancient enemies of Israel, according to Exodus 17, verse 8. And God had ordered back then Saul to wipe out the Amalekites, those from ruled by King Agag. But Saul didn't comply, and he spared Agag, whom the prophet Samuel later put to death. The name Agag seems to denote prime ruler. It could have been a title borne by all Amalekite kings, as explained in the Beyond Today Bible commentary on Obadiah, but it's likely that the Edomites ranged over a wide area in ancient Middle East, and possibly the Amalekites eventually settled in Central Asia. So it could well be that the Persian province of Agag was made up of Amalekites. And Haman's reaction to desire to exterminate the entire Jewish peoples might best be explained by him being an Amalekite, his heritage. Josephus says that Haman determined to abolish the whole nation, for he was naturally an enemy to the Jews, and because the nation of the Amalekites, of which he was and had been, destroyed by them. And so, you see, Satan hates the nations of Israel and keeps alive a culture of hatred toward Jews, even to this day, to the present. So this ancient animosity and envy over Israel's blessings goes all the way back to the conflict between Jacob and Esau. Jacob on the Israelite side, Esau from whom the Edomites and Amalekites were descended. And in the Middle East, those antagonisms are still there today. So why did Mordecai refuse to bow? Why didn't he bow to Haman? Haman was the administrator. Shouldn't we just honor all government administrators? It's because you shouldn't bow to another human being, or no? It was the accepted culture of the day to bow to other people. Mordecai's refusal was likely tied to knowing the kind of person that Haman was. As we read through this, we'll read that Haman was a despicable person who wanted to exterminate the Jews. And it's likely that that Mordecai saw the signs of this and understood Haman to be an enemy of his people. In Psalm 15, verse 4, the one who abides in God's temple, the one who will dwell on God's holy hill, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. If we read commentaries on Psalm 15, verse 4, this means that the person of God does not show respect to someone of bad character, regardless of their wealth, position, or rank in life. The phrase refers to someone who estimates character as it is in itself and not derived from rank, relationship, or station in life. So some people say we must give honor to every evil person if they have rank. But Mordecai refused to bow or do homage to the high-ranking Haman. And in the end, Mordecai, Esther, and all the Jews were blessed. Well, you might say Mordecai did not refuse to bow because Haman was evil, only because one must not bow to another human. But Scripture shows in many places it was not wrong to bow, or the Hebrew word saba, S-A-B-A, which also means give reverence to other people. So the act of bowing itself was not an issue. The issue was the character of Haman and Mordecai's refusal to honor Haman. In Esther 3, verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then Haman was full of wrath. Ooh, somebody refused to bow to the guy who thought so much of himself. In times of Scripture, and if we look on Strong's Concordance H7812, the same word for bow means to reverence, but it's also translated sometimes as bowed. Then there are many examples, I'm not going to go through all of those today, about many of the cases where Abraham and Joseph and others, in fact, did bow. So it wasn't that you shouldn't bow ever. But there are many of those examples, Genesis and Exodus, Ruth bowed to Boaz, David bowed to Jonathan, and so forth. But Haman's identity as an Amalekite would explain Mordecai's refusal as a Jew to bow. It wasn't wrong to bow to human leaders, as we've just looked over some of those in Genesis and 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 Kings. Some believe that what Xerxes, Persian king, expected with regard to people bowing was tantamount to worship. But it could be that the fact that Haman was an ancestral enemy of the Jewish people would be reason enough. Now comes Haman's character. If we read on, we read that Haman tricked the king, Ahasuerus, into issuing a decree that on a certain day all the Jews of every age could be killed and their possessions seized. And there is the law of the Medes and the Persians that once a king issues an order, it can never be rescinded. And so King Ahasuerus told Haman, yeah, well, if we've got these enemy people out there and they're living among us, yeah, we can get rid of those and you can take their possessions. Well, then Mordecai asked his cousin Esther to intercede with the king on behalf of the Jews to save them. But Esther knew if she went before the king without being invited, she could suffer the death penalty. And she would say, and this is in Esther chapter 4, and she said, you know, the king hasn't seen me for the last month, for the last 30 days. And if he doesn't extend his scepter to me, it could mean the death penalty. You don't go before the king unless you're an invited. And if you do show up, if he better extend his scepter to accept you, or it's the death penalty. And Esther 4 and verse 13, Mordecai issues a statement that is still repeated today. Esther 4:13, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? She was put on the spot. This is you. You are the queen. You have to make a decision, and it's up to you to step up to this responsibility. And Esther now had received the high title of queen, but she still listened to her and honored the cousin who brought her up. What do we read in Esther 4, starting in verse 16? In Esther's words, she listened to her cousin Mordecai and said, go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days or 3 days, nights or a day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. How many of us have done without food or water for 3 days? This was it. She knew it was pretty serious stuff. And if you're going to go down, you want to go down honorably, which she was determined to do. Not only does Esther now do the commandment of Mordecai, but Mordecai then reciprocally listens and cooperates with Esther. It seems that these two, the adoptive father and daughter, had that close working relationship. And together, working together, they were able to defeat the evil Haman and save the Jews. We read in Esther 4, verse 17, Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded him. Now, God is not mentioned, interestingly enough, in the book of Esther. I think it's the only book in the Bible where specifically the name of God is not mentioned. And yet, you can see that these people had the blessing of God. They had the protection and the safety. Now, we went to Esther 4 and verses 13 and 14, where Mordecai said, don't think you're going to escape just because you're in the king's palace. And so in the Beyond Today Bible commentary, Mordecai, in those verses, when he says, you know, don't think you're going to get away with anything, is really the central message of the entire book. That deliverance would come from somewhere else if she refused to act. But she may suffer consequences, but somehow, some way, the Jews would survive because they would still exist as a people. Because they look at how many times they were delivered time and time again through history, through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God had made many promises that could not be fulfilled if the tribes were wiped out. So Mordecai had the faith and the confidence that God would save his people, even under such serious circumstances. And refusal, if Esther refused to act, she would be facing a warning that could be divine punishment, reminiscent of Christ's later remark concerning in Luke 17, verse 33, that whoever seeks to save his life will lose it as an end time referral. In other words, it's not just about you. It's about your people or God's people. But of course, did God really need Esther? No, God could have saved the people from some other way. But he had placed Esther in her current position to use her if she were willing. And she was, and she stepped up to the task. We have a commentary, McLaren's exposition, that Mordecai's words carry large truth applicable to us all. The source of all endowments of position, possessions, or capacity is God. His purpose in them all goes far beyond the happiness of the receiver. Dignities and gifts of every sort are ours for use in carrying out his great designs of good to our fellows. Esther was made the queen, not that she might live in luxury and be the plaything of the king, but that she might serve Israel. Power becomes duty. Responsibility is measured by capacity. Obligation attends advantages. Gifts are actually burdens. All men are steward, and God gives his servants their talents, not for selfish squandering or hoarding, but to trade with and to pay the profits to him. This penetrating insight into the source and intention of which all we have carries a solemn lesson for us all. So, in that particular commentary. So, the argument, they're saying, holds reference in many forms of conflict with national and social evils. That if Christian people allow vice and godlessness to go unchecked, they won't escape the results in some way or another. So if we tolerate godlessness, then the godliness of the church is cooled down, as the commentary goes, by the low temperature around us. I thought of it this way. When we're swimming, that's the water we're swimming in. We don't want to be contaminated by it. We have to stand up against that. In Esther 5 and verse 9, when the king told Haman, go ahead and issue a ruling under my name, here's my seal, that kill all the Jews on a certain date and take their possessions. Esther 5, 9, Haman went out that day joyful with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he, Mordecai, didn't stand or tremble before him, Haman, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. And Esther 5, 13, Haman says, all of this avails me nothing as long as I can see Mordecai the Jew sitting in the king's gate. He wanted him punished. And then we go on to Esther book and chapter 6, and the king couldn't sleep. Ever have a sleepless night? What do you do? You say, well, I want to do something productive. And what did the king do in chapter 6? He asked for the king's historical record to come out and be read to him. And the historical record revealed that Mordecai had saved the king's life. Now we come to a remarkable little scenario in Esther chapter 6 and verse 6. Because the king wanted to do something to honor the person who had saved his life. And Haman was hanging around the palace, verse 6, Esther 6, 6. So the king calls him in. Verse 6, so Haman came in and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? He's placed Haman over all of the empire under the king. So he naturally assumed the king was referring to him. Like, wow, I'm a great guy and the king wants to honor me. And he's even asking me how to do it. Verse 7, and Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, on which a royal crest is placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Haman was picturing himself riding on the king's horse, had all the king's livery, the crest on the horse. You may have seen some decorations on prancing horses. And to be honored publicly. Esther 6, verse 10, and the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robe, the horse, as you've suggested, and now the bite. And do so for Mordecai the Jew who sits in the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all you have spoken. What do you suppose was in Haman's heart right about that time? A little squishy, maybe? Maybe he's ready to throw up. Maybe he's ready to jump off a high building. He realized that things were not working. And as we read on through the book of Esther, things didn't go well for Haman or his offspring. And eventually they all died. The Jews survived. What does that have to do then with the modern issue between the modern nation of Israel and the modern nation of Iran, formerly called Persia? Well, at that time, this was over 1,000 years, at the time of the book of Esther, was over 1,000 years before Islam had existed. And they were able to somehow get along. It wasn't illegal to be a Jew in Persia. It may have been difficult. They were a conquering country. But now you take over 1,000 years later in the country of Iran. Now, I've had done business with Iranians who fled in 1979, the Iranian Revolution, when it was taken over by the Islamic, what they called Islamic Republic. And I've had a number of Iranian students, Persian-speaking students over the years. And I've learned from them about them, why they left, how they left, what they did. We even had a family that went back to Iran for a visit. And this must be 5-7 years ago. And a student brought back a little statue. And he said, I had to smuggle this out of Iran for you. He said, I know you're a history teacher, but he said, in Iran, they want to, the Islamic Ayatollahs want to purge the kings of old because they got rid of the, in 1979, got rid of the king in Iran. And indeed, there's a crown prince waiting to back and resume government again. So he said, they're afraid that people will honor the kings and want to bring them back. So he said, I smuggled this one out, this little statue of an ancient king in Iran. Oh, thank you. And this, but he said, this was dangerous. But he was actually brave enough, you know, 14-year or 15-year-old kid was brave enough to do that. And he, but he said, they are afraid of the mindset of the kings of old. But look what is different now compared to 1979, before the Islamists took over, and what has happened since then, when the Islamists rule. Prior to 1979, it was one of the most westernized countries in the Middle East. Since 1979, I'll read a list of things that are illegal. One of them is apostasy, leaving Islam. Punishable by death, especially for people who publicly renounce Islam, women could face life in prison. So if you're claiming to not be Islam or leaving Islam, you could very well die. In fact, count on it. Secondly, was blasphemy. What do they call blasphemy? Insulting the prophet or any of the sacred Islamic figures, that's a death penalty. It doesn't matter if it's in a cartoon, in a movie, art, or speech, it's a death penalty. Another item against the law is what's called corruption on earth. This is kind of a vague charge used against dissenters, protesters, or activists, and often results in the death penalty. It's how you get rid of people who you disagree with. Then there's alcohol consumption. If Muslims are caught drinking, there's 80 lashes per offense. If you have 4 offenses, execution. So, alcohol consumption is forbidden. Then there's the female hijab law, which is mandatory for all women to wear the full covering. And if they don't, prison for up to 10 years. They may be flogged, whipped, fines, or have constant surveillance until they reform. Then there's the law against criticizing the supreme leader. Even if a humorous meme can lead to arrest, if there's public dissent, 1 to 10 years in prison. That'll slow down some dissent, right? Here's one, a law that says public affection is illegal of unmarried couples. If you hold hands or any kiss in public, that'll give you up to 74 lashes of the whip. Another law, women need husbands' permission to travel, to get a passport, leave the country, or do any traveling because they can't travel alone. Number 12, child marriage. The legal age for marriage, girls have to be 13. However, they can be younger if the father and the court approve, which really makes people twitch. So they have this concept of child marriage. There's compulsory military service for men only. And if they don't do their service, they're banned from traveling, can't get jobs, or go to university. Cybercrime. If you criticize Islam or the regime online, prison, seizing your assets, and live under constant surveillance. Another law, if you wear Western clothing or Western music, you are subject to fines, property confiscation, or arrest. This I found interesting. Women are banned from stadiums. They still largely can't go to men's sporting events. I don't know how many women want to in that. But if they defy that, ban, they will be arrested. This law is interesting. Is no public singing or dancing alone in public. It's illegal for women to do so. Can't dance or sing. Punishable by fines or jail. Now, the next one is gender segregation. Schools, buses, and workplaces are separated by law. And if people violate that, there are fines or expulsion. And then this one I had to chuckle about is dog ownership is banned. If somebody, because dogs are unclean, and you walk your dog in public, you could get thrown into jail and your pet would be seized and you can be sure you would never see it again. So that's the Islamic modern law. Now, Islam was established in the 7th century AD, in the early 600s, and there are different sects of Islam that have been developed. The Persian or Iranian version is called Shia. The followers are called Shiite Muslims. The followers of Islam in Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations are known as Sunni Muslims. And these two sects are highly unfriendly to each other. They would readily kill each other for just not being a good enough Muslim. And indeed, that's been going on for since 1200 or earlier. There are five duties incumbent upon every Muslim. They call them the pillars of Muslim. And if you fail to perform those, then you will suffer. And that includes the Muslim profession of faith. It has to be prescribed in a manner five times each day. You've heard of the sirens or the horns that call for that public prayer. An alms tax to benefit the poor and the needy. Fasting during the month of Ramadan. Now, what they call fasting is not what we call fasting. They just fast during daylight hours. And then at night, it's a party. And then they fast during the daylight hours, and the next night, it's a party. But they call that fasting. And they must sometime in their life, if financial and physical permission conditions permit, make a major pilgrimage to Mecca, which is in Saudi Arabia, which is under the Sunni Muslims. So the Shia are not too fond of that thought of going to Saudi Arabia. The question I want to leave us with today, do we have the strength and faith of Mordecai? Mordecai had the maturity and responsibility to look after his own household, indeed raising his own younger cousin in a very responsible manner. Next, Mordecai had respect in his community. He was a decision maker sitting in the gates. So do we have that faith and strength to be respected and honored that way? Mordecai had the honor and respect with a positive relationship with family members when he both gave advice to Hadassah, or Esther as she was called, and giving advice and taking advice. It was a close working relationship. And Mordecai had the vision or the foresight to see what affects one person can affect an entire nation. Well, the conflict in the Middle East continues, and it will continue to the end of this current age. And despite the crazy influence of the world's decisions, our individual responsibility includes being the best Christians that we can be. And that includes to follow the commandments of God, to be good decision makers, to look forward to the return of Jesus Christ to earth, look forward to the establishment of the kingdom of God, and then joining the family of God. So let's all be a good Mordecai or a good Esther.